everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Bowdrin. They call me Booker. With me, my beloved, beloved co-host, Lord Barrence Rose. Barrence, it is episode 113. How are things in Ambler, PA?
It's snowing, Jeff. It's snowing, and I'm fighting a really stiff neck and a turkey. I'm still in a turkey coma from all the bird, all the gobble I ate on Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say Mrs. Rose flipped you the bird again, because you know that's always could be a possibility.
Yeah. Oh, it could be a possibility.
So anyway, on this show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture, and life. Today, we are going to hit a number of topics, some wrestling, a little bit of movie info to pass along to you guys. Today, as recommended by our old friend Benji Fido, we are going to be looking at, from WrestleMania 8, Bret the Hitman Hart versus Hot Rod himself, Roddy Piper. And we're also going to be offer up five, count them, five documentaries for you to consider to spend your viewing time on. Barry, are you about ready to go?
I think, Jeff, this is going to be an epic episode. You just get the feeling that with this past weekend,
every episode has a feel of epicness, I think you could safely say.
And Jeff, I have a question as well too. So with your appearance, on the 100th episode of the 605 dropped this week, dropped on Thanksgiving Day. We're recording just a couple of days after, as I had mentioned. Have book sales skyrocketed? Your appearance, Jeff, stole the show, in my opinion. This was an 8-hour episode, I believe, of the 605, but you completely just stole the episode. How many thousands of copies of your book have flown off the shelves?
Just in our group alone, the numbers are in the tens of thousands, because of course every person that is part of our Facebook group, that is a listener of this fine podcast, I know, has, you know, in the holiday season, and in the spirit of the holidays, has reached inside not only their heart, but their wallet and or pocketbook and purchased a copy of They Call Me Booker, available at crowbarpress.com. Thank you for that plug, Barry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, too. And I got to say, too, great book. I did enjoy the 100th episode again. I think that you clearly were the – Jeff, you were so good, they should give you your own podcast. That's how
good
you are.
They really should. I think I was better than Howard Baum. You know, I love the Magnificent One, but, you know, I just think I was head and shoulders above the Magnificent One. No, I'm just kidding. Howard's an old friend. So, Barry, before we get started on our match of the week and our movie selections, got to ask you a question that came up on the old Facebook page, on your personal page, Barry. My wife, my daughter, the whole family want to know the story about Lord Barrence visiting, what was it, the Animal Control, the Humane Society, and in your interactions with a trooper, the three-legged boxer.
Oh, God, Jeff, you're going to make me get weepy when I start to bring this up. So my daughter has been – my daughter loves dogs, and she loves Ozzy.
The lovely Zoe,
lovely and talented Zoe, who was fighting a cold, but yet was able to muster up the courage to head off to 10th grade today. But she's been wanting a dog that she can walk. And a lot of it is Ozzy is close to 100 pounds. He's very strong. And if Ozzy wants to go, Ozzy's going to go. You're not going to stop him. So she wants a dog that she can walk and take out. And we've been going to look at dogs at various shelters, and she said, hey, there's this place. It's maybe 20 minutes away. I was there. They've got these great puppies. And I said, okay. And she goes, and the selling point with this, Jeff, was she said to me, you know, there's a Popeyes right next door. So I was like, fuck yeah, we can go to Popeyes. We'll get the chicken sandwich. So we walk in. And immediately there's puppies, Jeff. There are puppies everywhere. There are these beautiful puppies, 8 to 9 weeks old. But I was drawn to this three-legged boxer. And I don't know if it was the expression. Sometimes it's love at first sight. It was the expression on his face. And I said, this is why everybody wants to adopt a puppy, because they're puppies. All babies are cute. Puppies, kittens, doesn't matter. But this is the type of dog that you should be adopting. This is what it's really about. So we asked if we could see Trooper. And Trooper, this is going to be tough, because I really have bonded with Trooper. And So Trooper had a very sad backstory. He came up from your current home state, Jeff, came up from Georgia, and his owners had tied him to a tree, and the rope that they had used to tie him to the tree had become wrapped around his leg, cut off all the circulation, and they had to surgically remove his leg.
Sometimes I wish we could do that to people that do that to their dogs, you know?
And my wife, who normally is maybe a little more composed in certain situations than I am, was just livid when she met Trooper and she read this story. And we really were. My daughter, my Zach was in town, and he couldn't have been a sweeter, more lovable. So here's a dog with three legs. And this is, we're looking at the last week to week and a half that this operation had taken place. He's hopping around, and every time you either say his name or give him any sort of attention, this little stub of a tail that he has just starts to move. And considering all this dog had been through, I was just really touched by it. We took him out. We walked him around. Every time he saw puppies, Jeff, he went over to the puppies, just gentle. He greeted everybody else there. He's a people type of dog. He loves other dogs. He was just the sweetest thing. And when I talk with him, you know, because I do this thing where I, as you do, we all dog owners do it. I'm not, you know, we all do it. We talk to our dogs, and I'm telling him how much I love him, what a good boy he is. And he just puts his face right on my lap and just stares at me. And I was like, holy fuck, like this dog is the smartest dog in the history of dogs, because he's figured out he's going to get adopted. This is going to happen. So so we saw Trooper, and this was, I think, on a Thursday. And we left, and I thought about Trooper all night. And we went back on Friday to see Trooper. And that's where I posted the photos. And we had a long talk to get all of his history and everything about him. And, you know, it's really – he's only 4 years old. He's missing a tooth up front. That doesn't happen by accident. I mean, it could happen, but it comes from neglect, obviously, is really what I was trying to say. And I spent about an hour with him. I just sat there and just held him and scratched him and talked with him. So we are looking. There's a couple of things right now that do prevent him. First off, they don't want to release him until he's fully healed, which sure. which makes a lot of sense, because I can't bring him home with Ozzy, because Ozzy will want to play with Trooper, and that can't happen right now. The other aspect is Trooper is still packing. He's still carrying his boys. So I also...
Oh my, yes.
Oh my is right. I cannot bring him home because Ozzy is great with dogs that have been neutered, but I can't bring a non-neutered male into the house, or it's going to be a bloodbath. So over the next couple of weeks, he is scheduled, and then we're going to introduce Ozzy and Trooper. And if all goes well and all works out in this world, Trooper will be picking up my last name. So my fingers are crossed, my toes are crossed, and I'm very excited about it.
Well, on behalf of the Bowdrins, let us say that we hope that goes through. But a question from a vet tech, Kelly Cohn, my daughter.
Yes.
Did you not, in fact, say that Trooper was also being treated for something else?
Yeah. So sadly, too. And that's a major thing. And then we can actually talk about that, too. Whoa.
That was Gunn.
Gunny. You said Kelly's name. He got all excited.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Yeah, Trooper has heart. So, but going along with the neglect of losing a leg based off of the ineptitude of his owners, losing a tooth, God knows how, and he has a beautiful face, but he also has heartworms, which is purely based out of neglect also. And that's a big heart, you know, heartworms are a big thing, and it's something that can be cured right now, but later on in life for dogs, it leads to a lot of issues. So, part of adopting him is that they pick up any medical costs of anything that's associated with any of his conditions currently. So I did check into it. As long as I go to their specific vet, which is, you know, 20-25, not too far from me, then if there are issues related to heartworm, they will pick that up in the future, because that could obviously run in the thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things that Kelly pointed out, and I'm not sure if they mentioned this to you, but when you have a dog that's being treated for heartworm, after the treatment is finished, there is a period where they need to be, dare I say, relatively calm and sedate. And I'm just figuring that any interaction with Ozzy is going to involve some sort of either roughhousing or wanting, right. You know, of course, Ozzy being a dog, he's going to want to play. And so I don't know how that's going to, you know, be managed, if that's being considered yet or not. We are the Dog Friendly Podcast here on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, Barry.
We definitely are, Jeff. And it's that kind of, and I've referenced the TV show Dexter. There's got to be a deck. And we've talked about Dexter for dogs and animals. There's got to be something. You know, I know that
I smell a Netflix series here.
Come there on. Should be. There really should be. You know, these poor, look, we love dogs. Obviously, you and I do. But there's a lot of people in our group that post photos of their dogs. And if you have a dog, it's a family member. It's not a dog. It's your child. It's part of your family. You care. Ozzy gets injured, I cry. I'm devastated. So just to think that there are people out there that are neglectful and mistreat these dogs. And I asked her, I said, he's so sweet. He's so lovable. His owners must have been nice to him, just neglectful. And she said, no, unfortunately, we see this. There's a syndrome. I don't know what the name of it is, but there's a syndrome that even dogs that are mistreated will still be loving towards the owners that are mistreating them. So I don't know the full situation. I can tell you these fuckholes in Georgia that obviously cost this poor dog, chaining him up to a tree and cost him his leg because, you know, he was out there with all the circulation being cut off. And I know that there's a law that's going into effect. But you know, it's devastating. It's just absolutely devastating to see it.
Yeah, and you know, we've said this before about a couple of different subjects. It's, you know, first, do no harm. If you're not a fan of dogs or pets of cats or anything else, that's fine. You know, go your own way. Yeah. But, you know, don't adopt an animal and mistreat it. That's, you know, I don't understand the mindset there. You know, if you have an animal that for whatever reason you can't keep, you know, there are places that will take these animals, no kill shelters. Don't chain it to a tree or put it in harm's way, you know. And that goes without saying, you know, one of these, you know, we got the holiday seasons coming up and people adopt pets. And then, you know, 3 or 4 months later, they abandon the animal or they just dump the animal. And don't even get me started on these pictures on Facebook where people have a dog for 14 or 15 years, the dog's starting to have health problems. Oh. So they drop it off at the fucking, you know, Humane Society because they want to get a puppy. Oh, go fuck yourself. Yes. All kind of different ways on that one, Barry. So,
yep. 100% too. Sweet Lou checking in too. Sweet Lou checking in. First, they make the eyes at you and then the Sarah McLachlan song kicks in and then you have to give in. And boy, is he 100% right? Because I believe
that's the first time Lou has ever been 100% correct.
Yeah,
so
but
congratulations, Lou.
And he's right because I think they were actually playing that Sarah McLachlan song on an endless loop when I walked in the building.
Yeah. Okay, Barry, since you're a food guy, moving along now to a less depressing topic, you're a food guy, I have a couple of food related questions for you here. First of all, Barry saw this on the old Twitter or Facebook. Barry, if you were offered a free year of one particular type of food, what would it be?
It'd be pizza. It would
pizza.
Be pizza. Yeah.
The wife and I were discussing that in the car. I said, well, you know, I'd choose steak probably because of the, you know, the cost and the expense. But, you know, if you're getting all the steak at once, you know, the steak, you put some in the freezer. Chances are next 12 months from now, it's going to have a little freezer burn. But if you're getting it delivered to you like weekly or something, I'm going to go steak because, you know, whatever food you choose, there's going to be a certain point where you just go, okay, I'm getting a little sick of the pizza here, you know?
Sure.
But I thought that was a pretty interesting question. Now, Barry, also food related, and I hope you remember the story to which I'm going to reference. You had pointed out someone posted a story or maybe it was some sort of a joke about a guy who was out to dinner with his girlfriend and the girlfriend started bitching about that he was leaving too much for the server.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you said, I have got a story about this. Barry, the floor is yours. Tell us your favorite food server related story involving a girlfriend or boyfriend bitching about how much is being tipped to the server.
Yeah, well, that, so it's not. It's a little different, and that's where I. But it did involve money, and that's where I think I said it. There's a similar story. It's a little different. There, look, there's when I was waiting on tables before I moved into management, I would bitch about people tipping all the time, and some days you'd walk away and you were absolutely thrilled, and then other times you'd walk away and you go, I busted my ass, I did everything right, I was friendly, and you left me, 6%. You know, how in God's name? We're not talking about people from Germany or England. You know, I know in Europe it's completely different, but people from our country. But years ago, there was a restaurant. This is for all my New York people. There was a restaurant on the Upper West Side called Nico's, and I don't believe it's still there. I think it's gone. But it was a Greek restaurant. My wife and I think we were dating at the time. We might be married. I don't know. It was definitely the early, it was prior to Zach. So it's over 18 and a half years ago. But we used to go every Sunday night. I was working in the restaurant industry, so I would work the day. And then every Sunday night, we would walk to this restaurant. We always got the same thing, and it was our kind of our deal. So one night we're in the restaurant, and there is a guy, I'm going to say he's an older guy, but certainly he's younger than I am right now. So, there's a mind fuck for you when I'm thinking of a story 20 years ago and I'm, oh, there's an older guy. Wait a minute. He's younger than I am right now. So there was a guy, looked like a construction worker, kind of a blue collar guy. And the way he spoke was, this was a blue collar guy, and he was with a woman. I'll say she was late 30s, maybe up to mid 40s, and they were having dinner, and she had the grilled calamari. Jeff, do you like calamari, by the way?
I do not, but thank you for asking.
Absolutely. So she was having the grilled calamari, and he says to her, we're sitting right near, so we're not even eavesdropping. You just literally can hear every word. And he says to her, he says, and he was a nice guy. He says, are you enjoying the calamari? I really hope you are. That really costs a lot. And she said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, it's really good. It's an expensive, menu item. And she got very offended by that. And he tried to explain. This went on for 15 minutes. He tried to explain himself, and he didn't have a way. He wasn't like you, Jeff. He didn't have a way with words. like this poor guy, the more he said, the deeper the fucking hole got. So he's trying to tell her, and he's like, no, I didn't mean it like this. I just meant, it's a really good item and it's just expensive. And she kept getting more offended, and she stops eating and goes, I think I have to go now. And can you take me home? And he's like, Mary. And I remember her name. It was Mary. Mary, please, please, let's finish our dinner and then I'll drive you. And she starts putting on her jacket. She's standing up. She goes, I want to go home now. And that was it. My wife and I just looked at each other and were like, fuck. And I kind of fell for the guy because I could tell. And I don't, I don't really know, but it certainly seemed to me that this guy just made some sort of faux pas. He didn't intend to rub in that this is costing him an arm and a leg. And she was really offended, and that wrapped up their date. My wife and I, though, had a fantastic dinner that night, Jeff. We did not have the calamari, though.
So that brings to mind, Barry, tell me your favorite, in hindsight and in retrospect, maybe not at the moment, your favorite dating faux pas, because boy, I have one right now that I can throw at you.
You're talking about the favorite
something you did while you were dating. In retrospect, we went, oh, what the fuck was I thinking there?
Oh, absolutely, Jeff. And this will actually tie into this podcast. So I was dating a young lady. I was dating a young lady 1985 through 1988. We were semi-engaged, which is that unofficial engagement. And we had been dating for 6 months, and we flips on the TV one day, and Gordon Solie is on with Wahoo McDaniel. And I said, oh, look, it's fucking Wahoo McDaniel. And she said, how do you know about wrestling? And I said, and immediately, because yeah, I didn't, you know, immediately I said, oh yeah, you know, I know who some of these people are. Sometimes she goes, oh, I hate professional wrestling.
That's when the relationship is doomed.
And then a week later, Jeff, she's over my house. She goes into my closet, and that the closet at that stage was a little mini museum dedicated to wrestling. So, that was the faux pas. And that was at the stage where, look, I loved wrestling, but girls were girls. I mean, you know, let's be honest, you're in your early to mid 20s and there's going to be a precedent that's going to be taken. It's going to be women. So I tried to cover and do as much as I could, and I was able to because we stayed together for another 2.5 years. But yeah, that was a tough one.
Okay, so here's my faux pas, and you tell me which one you like better. So you may remember, Barry, my first wife's name was Sheila.
Yes.
And so Sheila and I had we were divorced at this time. My stepdaughter, when I was with Sheila, was named Cheryl.
Yes.
Are you with me so far?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
The girl that I began dating, right after the official divorce happened, her name was Sherry, okay? I apparently had some sort of phobia about people that had names along those lines. So anyway, so I'm at dinner with Sherry one night, and I'm telling a story to her. And as I'm telling her the story, I'm referencing her within the story, okay? And as I reference her within the story, I refer to her as Sheila.
Oh.
Thank you. And so at this point, she stops the story and she goes, excuse me. Yeah. Did you hear what you just did there? And I said, and I was like, and I really didn't realize, what did I do? And she goes, you referred to me as Sheila. And I go, no. She goes, no. No, you referred to me. as you could probably guess, things began to take a slight downward turn in the relationship there. So didn't work out. And, you know, the funny thing was, I want to say about a year and a half ago, the lovely Mrs. Boudrin and I are in Walmart. Lo and behold, I run into Sherry. And I hadn't seen her, God, in 30 years or so. It was crazy. And, you know, just running into old girlfriends in Walmart. That night when I actually called her my ex-wife's name, things did not go well after that. These things happen. So now, Barry, it is time for us to get to our match of the week as recommended by our old friend Benji Fido. And we are going to WrestleMania 8, Bret the Hitman Hart versus Roddy Piper. Okay, so Barry, we're at April 5th, 1992. This was Indianapolis, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, with WrestleMania 8 in Indianapolis, correct. Yeah.
And Bret Hart versus Roddy Piper. You had a chance to watch this, Barry. Tell me what you thought of this match.
Yeah, so I really liked this match. And I got to admit, I don't want to say I got weepy, but I got a little misty-eyed, Jeff, because Roddy Piper, he was such a great guy, first off. But he was such a, to me, when you look back at the annals of pro wrestling, especially 70s through the 90s, but for the 80s, Roddy Piper was it. And, you know, he was never a great ring technician, but he had this larger-than-life presence. And there are two guys, if I was putting together a fan fest, two guys that are no longer with us, one being Roddy Piper, I would have broke the bank to get him to one of our fan fests and one of our shows. The other being Sir Oliver Humperdinck, I love the guy on a personal level as well. But I really enjoyed this match. And what I liked about it, and I don't think you could show this match to somebody now who wasn't a fan in the 80s, and I don't think they're going to understand the importance of this match and what it meant. And the drama that surrounds it. Certainly you and I, having lived through this, and I believe I saw this when this came out, this is a really important match. And it's, as they call it, it's the passing of the torch in a sense. And really what I think they mean by that is Bret Hart getting his first singles heavyweight title in the Federation after being part of a tag team for years. And Roddy Piper clearly doing the job for him and then strapping the belt on at the end and raising Bret Hart's arm in victory. And so it really does come across as the passing of the torch. But I really do love this this match for a bunch of reasons. I love the beginning of it. They go eye to eye and nose to nose during the referee's instructions, and they're looking at each other. And there's a real intensity there. There's none of this clowning around gimmick stuff. These, you know, this looks very serious. Bobby Heenan, too. And Bobby Heenan, Gorilla Monsoon, I don't know if I appreciated them when I would hear them on a weekly basis. And I don't, you know, I probably a bunch of reasons that I felt that way. But in hindsight, some, you know, almost 30 years later, God, do I miss the Weasel in Gorilla. You know, they were just.
Yeah, they're absolutely on fire in this match, both of them.
They're on fire. We could say it.
They're on fire.
They may be the MVPs. You did steal it. They may be the MVPs of this match. So as they're staring at each other, Heenan goes, two ugly people looking at each other. That's fun. And Gorilla's like, what are you talking about? Piper is in great shape here in this match, too. He is. I don't know if he was coming off of doing some TV work or movie work. You know, if you look at him and They Live, you know, that he was in bodybuilder shape for the most part. Not quite the same shape, but really, really good shape here. This is a babyface versus babyface matchup. Two guys that I think knew each other for many, many years. Piper playing the subtle heel. And I don't know if heel is the correct word, but he cheap shots Hart. And Gorilla is Gorilla definitely being the babyface commentator. Bobby Heenan, that enthusiasm and respect that they have for each other makes me sick, which is such a great line. And Gorilla's right there with, what are you talking about, Brain? You know, that kind of stuff. Bret Hart hits it appears to be like towards the temple near his forehead. I believe this was Hardway, Jeff, was it?
I thought I saw him drop down to the mat and perhaps
okay.
Open up. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But so, it was very, very quick, and he did a really good job of it.
Yeah, did it. And it also not in the typical middle of the forehead. It's way off to the side. It looks to me like when Piper rammed his head into the turnbuckle and he went on the side of the turnbuckle, but he may have done the blade job on this as well. Heenan says that's from one of the short punches that Piper throws. Gorilla saying, I thought it was from the bulldog headlock. I thought it was from getting his head rammed into the turnbuckle. But Heenan and Gorilla,
I actually thought, not to interrupt you, I thought it was from when Piper had given him the gesture, like there was something wrong with his boot, and Bret went to go down to look at his boot, and Piper sucker punched him. I thought that's when they were playing off, that's when it had occurred.
Well, that's it. So he went from that sucker punch to the turnbuckle.
Okay.
So it could have been, and then but then he may have been on the mat. I wasn't paying attention to that part. So he may have done the blade when he was on the mat. It did look kind of real, though. So I thought that was great. Bobby Heenan also coming up with a great line. I remember when I was champion Monsoon, Gorilla says, champion of what? Heenan says, the neighborhood. No idea what the hell that means, but I love it. there's a ref bump. Piper then gets the timekeeper's bell and stands above Bret Hart like he's going to bash him with it, and does this for a good solid minute or two. And it's one of these conflicted moments. He wants to hit him, but he's not sure if he should hit him. So he winds up not hitting him with the timekeeper's bell. And he then gets the sleeper on Hart. Hart goes over to the turnbuckle, kicks off, and falls back on Piper, kind of, you know, does a flip over. Piper gets pinned 1, 2, 3, and you have a new Intercontinental Champion. I really do like this match, though, too. And I wasn't sure going into it how much I was going to like it. But I think the drama that surrounds it, I think these two guys built up such a great story for this match. And I can imagine, you know, and Benji, I don't know how old Benji is, and I don't know if Benji saw this as a kid. I know he's both younger than you and I are. But I could imagine if I was, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old, and I'm seeing this match at WrestleMania, this is probably going to stick with me. You know, this is something I am going to remember years later. So big thumbs up, Benji.
Yeah, this is, you're absolutely right. This match is, it's greater than the sum of its parts.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Because, you know, as good as the in-ring action is, the way they draw the story, you know, they draw, because it starts off with Bret kind of pulls a sly one where he you know, feigns like the shoulder is hurt or something like that and rolls Piper up.
Yeah.
And they go nose to nose on that. But that, yeah, there's a lot of that. The you know, the storyline is Piper giving Brett the rub. And, you know, I really, with all deference to his career in WCW, I really think this was Piper's last great singles match. Am I completely off base there?
No, I Jeff, I think you're absolutely correct. You're 100% correct.
Thank you. 100%.
He didn't look, his matches in WCW, I wouldn't say they were good. In fact, some of them were downright terrible. It's Piper's charisma and that aura that he had about him that I think got him over. And when he came back to the WWE and actually held the tag team titles with Ric Flair, he was not in shape. He was definitely older. He shouldn't have been in the ring at that stage. This probably was his last great match. I'd agree.
Yeah. And you're right. Some of the Heenan stuff that came out where Monsoon had mentioned that Piper used to be in a fight in the Golden Gloves. And Heenan says, "Those guys are amateurs. They're punks." And then the line where he said he was talking about, "You got to go. You got to win it for the moolah, for the samola, for the gold." And he said, "The only gold you have, Bobby, is in your teeth." And he said, "What do you think? I'm Japanese?" Which, first of all, that's completely inappropriate. I have no idea what the reference is to Japanese people having gold.
Right.
But it was a funny line. So let's see. They both do the sort of the old Flair Steamboat, Flair Wyndham, where they both tumble over the top rope. It was a nice save because when they first tried to do the move, yeah, they kind of got caught up. And I think both of them worked it out and got them over. Yeah, this was really all about Piper doing the honors, the time honored thing, as Vince likes to call it. But it was a really well done example of what an older veteran should do for the guy that they're making the star. And unfortunately, it's very few and far between at this point in time, as well as now, guys that are willing to do that, the guys that are willing to, you know, take the young up and coming guy, give him the rub, really make him the star, and then have that star just go off. I mean, a lot of times you have guys that'll put guys over, and then next week they're back there and, you know, they want their spot. I'm looking at you there, Double H, but, and Triple H actually, but, here, Piper really makes Brett into the rising star of the promotion. Of course, he would go on to win the world title not too far after that. So, yeah, thank you, Benji. This was a really, really good match. I mean, is it a match of the year? No, but it's definitely the kind of match that you can watch and appreciate, again, for the story that's told. And we'll put this up on the old Facebook page. When you watch it, remember, as you're watching the match, wait till the end and see and you can appreciate, as I said, the match being more than the sum of its parts. Because, again, as good as the stuff in the ring is, the stuff that happens sort of that wraps the storyline around it, I think that makes it even better. So so now, Barry, let's go on to somebody recently, names in the news. Some people just can't help themselves, Barry. They feel the need to try to, just keep getting themselves over, even though they've been out of the business for 20 fucking years, and they keep trying to stir the fucking pot. Let's talk about Chris Cruz, Barry.
So you want to get me all riled up. So this fucking guy. And so why don't we go back a little bit, Jeff, with this as well. Pardon me. I'm getting a little choked up right now. I have no problem with Chris Cruz as a television commentator when he was working third string, fourth string for WCW.
I actually liked his combo with Terry Funk.
Yeah, no problem whatsoever.
Combo. Yeah, no worries at all. Yeah.
No. This is not an indictment on his work as an announcer or anything like that. I think he was better than average. I think he was better than a lot. As a human being, though, he's done some really fucking shitty stuff. And there always seems to be this defense of Chris Cruz where he's playing a character. And somehow people, first off, I got to say, if you're playing a character on social media, I don't want to be too harsh. You know what? I'm not going to say what I was going to say, Jeff. That was really harsh. If you're
How about I'll say it? We do know people that play characters on social media.
We do.
They're in our group.
They are. Why? Why are you playing a character? Why don't you be yourself? Yes. Why don't you have a thought? Why do you have to be a character? So there is this defense of Chris Cruz where he's, oh, you're misreading him. He's just playing this heel character. Let me tell you about the heel character before we discuss what he's done currently. So, and I brought this up, and I actually had another run-in with him that I did not bring up, but a couple of years ago, in my CWF Archives Facebook group, I posted, it was the passing or birthday, and I forget which, it was the birthday of Gordon Solie, and Chris Cruz chimed in, and I actually, I believe I have it right here. Do I have it right here? No, maybe I don't. I may have deleted it. But Chris Cruz chimed in, and in a nutshell, what he basically said was, why glorify an old drunk? And, you know, I got to admit, I was very offended by that because we're talking about a guy, you know, look, there's no secret. Gordon drank a lot. Gordon's children, Gordon's daughter, Pam Allen, that you know extremely well, wrote a book and she addressed his alcoholism in the book. So this is not a secret. But for Chris to come on when his children, two of his four children, are in the group that were commenting on the post and say, why glorify an old drunk? Holy fuck, that's major asshole status right there. So since that time, and I did tell that story, he did it again, and Pam Allen runs a Facebook group as a tribute to her father, and he got in there, and he started, and Pam, Jeff, you know her extremely well. She's the nicest woman. She's very spiritual. She's highly intelligent. She's not aggressive. She's a teacher. She's a grandmother. She's not aggressive in any form. And she also was taking a lot of shit from this fucking prick. And he was in there basically berating Gordon on this group. And Pam, to her credit, wasn't stepping up to go toe to toe with him. I have no problem doing that. So I let him know how I feel and how I felt that day. He's a fucking asshole and a piece of shit. And I got to admit, if you think that this guy is playing a character, and if you think it's okay to go on and to berate the parents of a woman who's in her mid to late 60s, who's a very peaceful, spiritual woman, then you and I have an issue because it's wrong. It's 100% wrong. So this guy's a fucking dick. And this past week, or maybe it was last week, and I actually saw it because he was posting about it on Facebook. He had reached out to the Athletic Commission of the state of Maryland to talk about the John Moxley-Kenny Omega match that occurred at the last pay-per-view, which I believe was the 9th of November. It was the AEW pay-per-view. And I don't remember the entire gist of it. And he's an intelligent guy. I mean, he definitely communicates and does, you know, you get everything he's saying, but they didn't respond to him. And he continued to send email after email until he finally got a response. So this wasn't a one-off for Chris Cruz. This wasn't where I'm going to send an email and then check in 3 months. This is, I want an answer and I want to know why. So basically he wants to know why AEW was allowed to get away with the blood and the blading. And, you know, Maryland's always had this issue with having blood in matches and why they were allowed to get away with it. But you have to wonder, what was his motivation with this? So the story has since come out, since initially he spoke about it, that they were already investigating this claim. And I don't know that to be a fact. I don't have, you know, that could be damage control in some form or somebody's assumption. I don't know that to be true. But Chris Cruz had no idea when he contacted the commission that they were already investigating the claim. So what's his motivation, Jeff? What's his motivation for wanting, what is he, does he want to save people? Does he want to save fans from the blade? Does he want to make sure that everybody is treated on an equal playing field? The same guy that mocks people when they say rip Harley Race or rip any other professional wrestler who's died. And then he comes out, brings out his soapbox, stands on top of it, puffs his inverted chest out and says, oh, I guess you knew them well, drop dead, stuff like that, where he mocks people's grief. What's his motivation with this, Jeff? I ask you. Lou Kippelman, you're aware of this situation. I ask you as well, what is this fucking penis's motivation in this entire situation?
Well, I cannot speak for Chris Cruz's penis, but
That's inverted also, much like
the
chest.
The penis wants to remain silent on the issue.
Yes. Nor would I want to in any case. Yeah, troll's gonna troll. And he found something to latch onto and sort of boost his signal and keep his cred as a wrestling gadfly / malcontent / worker going.
Yeah, you know what it strikes me as, guys? Are you familiar with what a remora is?
Yes, yeah. It's the thing that gets the whatever the shark leaves.
Exactly,
it's the thing that swims next to it.
Exactly, yes. That's what Chris Cruz is. He's there to pick up the table scraps of the wrestling industry. Okay, and as Lou, I will give him credit for this line. Said this whole scenario involving AEW, this scenario should be titled AEWTF. Because what the fuck, Chris? I mean, come on, quit sitting around waiting for some table scraps to float by for you to feed on. Your career was over fucking almost 30 years ago. You had a nice run. Your run with Terry Funk in WCW, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. You went your way after that. Okay. Guess what? It's over, Johnny. It's over. It's over for you, Chris. Nobody fucking cares anymore. Go back to your own little pathetic existence. No one fucking cares.
And of course, Chris Cruz shits on everybody until somebody brings up his kryptonite, Saint Bruno.
Yes, correct. And that right there is that's the definition of hypocrisy. Look, and I what a great guy Bruno was, and this would never, but you know, he will shit, as Lou just said. Lou, I'm very happy we had you on with this segment, by the way. He will shit on everybody. So Jeff, if your favorite wrestler that's still living, when Terry Funk passes, which I think we're all in agreement, Terry Funk is easily one of our favorites. When he passes, there is going to be grief that we're going to feel. We are going to post a photo that we have taken with Terry Funk. As Lou just said, he's going to shit all over that, and he's going to mock your grief. However, when Bruno passed, it was the complete opposite for him because he had an invested interest emotionally in that.
Yeah, it's, you know, Like other people that we know, it just like you feel like you have this role you have to portray and, you know, get a fucking life. You know, it's sad. It's pathetic. And we've given him more time than he deserves, quite frankly. So now, Barry, thank you again, Lou. Now, Barry, it's time for us to offer our opinions. Folks, you're out there. You're wondering what to do on a lovely Saturday afternoon. And you decide, I'm going to take a chance and see what documentaries are out there. So I reached out to Mr. Rose and I said, Bear, come up with 5 documentaries. We are not going to offer the 20-minute review on each of these films because, quite frankly, we'll end up having a 2-part episode like a certain other Arcadian Vanguard member who I shall not mention at this point in time right now. But we each have 5 that we can recommend. I will dare say that our choices are vastly different. We have a gamut and a scope that is really we don't think alike, apparently, Barry.
That's true. Sometimes we do. Sometimes
on certain things. So give me your first choice, Barry.
Yeah, that is funny, too. So, Jeff, I watch documentaries later at night, and it's almost either Netflix or Prime for me, and I'll go right to the docs. And I've learned something when it comes to documentaries is I don't have to read the brief summary of what it's about to really form an opinion. Because sometimes, as you'll see with some of my movies, they don't sound exciting. And then you watch it and you go, my God, that was like earth changing for me. It just, you know, they're amazing. So the first one, Jeff, is a movie that I watched probably 6 or 7 months ago. It's called The Parking Lot Movie. Have you ever heard of this film, Jeff?
I can honestly say, now knowing what your 5 choices are, I don't think I've seen or heard of one of the movies.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go. So this movie was released in 2010. The parking lot movie basically is a documentary about a small, very small parking lot in Charlottesville, Virginia. And it follows a very select group of parking lot attendants and their strange rites of passage. This brotherhood of attendants consists of grad students, overeducated philosophers, surly artists, middle-aged slackers, and a host of others.
That describes half our group, Barry.
That disguised 90% of our group, Jeff. But what this really is if you've ever seen the movie Clerks, and I know you have, that's exactly what these guys are. These are the clerks who are basically parking lot attendants. It's really interesting. They prefer skateboards and bicycles to cars. Most of them don't even drive, even though they're parking lot attendants. They have a contempt for the people that they're serving. They mock and ridicule many of them. A lot of times when they're not even working, they just show up just to shoot the shit with the other attendant. It's become this cool subculture hangout atmosphere of this small little parking lot, which is real old school. There's no automated tickets. You pay the guy when you get in, but it's riveting. As I sit here and I watch it, you know, and I've watched it twice, actually, this movie to me was riveting. And this is a real case of initially when you read the plot summary, you go, wait, I'm going to watch a movie about parking lot attendants. The next thing you know, you realize you're watching fucking Clerks in the parking lot. So it's really interesting. And there's this great line. And it's one of the former parking lot attendants. And a lot of these guys are there 10 years later, you know, 11 years later, making $8 an hour or whatever it is. They never leave. But some have gone on. They've actually, you know, they've gotten married. They've had kids. They've led lives. But they all look back at this almost zen-like atmosphere of how impactful working at this parking lot was for them. And how important. But there's one former attendant says, we had it all in a world that had nothing to offer us. And after seeing this film, that line is so appropriate. So I give this, honestly, one of my highest recommendations. And it's not super long either, Jeff. It's maybe an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes. But if you did like Clerks, or if this sounds at all remotely interesting, I highly recommend it.
Well, I'll tell you, before I give you what I was thinking, you know, the length of the movie does not necessarily tell you, you know, what is the best film. Because as a matter of fact, in my five selections, as you were speaking, I realized that the one that I enjoyed the most and that impacted me the most is the one that's the shortest. It's not even an hour long. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. Yeah, you know, you're talking about these guys having the social interaction. And I'll tell you what I was thinking. You know, my wife's father, who's no longer with us, the last job that he had before he passed away was he was the manager of a mobile station in Broward County. And, you know, he on a daily basis had all these people that he interacted with, you know, whether it's just someone coming in to buy a pack of cigarettes, to buy a soda, a candy, a newspaper, whatever. That was his social interaction. And he ended up the business was purchased, I think, by the corporation. And so they let him go. And so he then spent most of his days sitting at home, not doing anything. And I told my wife, I said, the thing that your dad misses the most is that social interaction. You know, it's something that it was such a part of his life and part of his world that, you know, it was like having something just yanked out from under you. And I thought that was the cruelest thing that the company did when they sort of eased him out of his job. And, you know, so as you're talking about social interaction, we fail to realize a lot of times this is what you and I do, Barry. We're socially interacting with each other, with Lou, with our listeners, and it becomes a very important part of your life, and you don't realize it until it's gone.
I've said this before, so I didn't feel that good today. And once we start recording and just being able to talk and goof off, I'm already in it. My mood is already 100 times better. So I absolutely get it too. So if I can ask Jeff, how long after he was no longer with the company did he pass?
I want to say maybe 2 or 3 years. I mean, he had health issues. I mean, okay. Let's be honest. It wasn't because of that, but that didn't help, you know, because the interaction that he had, he saw me maybe weekly. He saw his daughter maybe, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times a week. And he saw my son, who he would pick up from school on almost a daily basis. That became a social interaction. And my son, because my son has Asperger's, my son is not a real social animal, you know? So it was really, I really felt like they just deprived him of something that was such a part of his life, you know? And to go from, you know, it's one thing if you're like a quiet, relatively reserved person, but, you know, my father-in-law was very outgoing, very gregarious guy. And, you know, he wasn't somebody I tried like the Dickens to see if I could get my son to introduce him to online so he could just interact with people online, if nothing else.
Right.
So,
sure.
But you don't realize what you miss until it's gone sometimes, I guess, is the message there. Okay, so Barry, my first choice for documentary came out in 2014, a subject you should be well familiar with. Oh, Barry, it's Khosrow Vaziri. It's The Sheik. It's the, I guess it's on Amazon. Wow. This movie I saw, and I've been wanting to watch it and wanted to watch it. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think the Sheik has become sort of a clownish figure. You know, you hear him on Stern with the, you know, I'm going to fuck him in the ass. I'll make him, you know, submit. And,
humble.
You know, yeah, that will humble him. Everybody's got their damn impression of the Sheik. But what you forget about as you see this.
Hey, Lou, Lou, is it possible that you can isolate where Jeff just said, I want to fuck him in the ass, and we can keep that and just play that over and over? Is that possible? Thank you, Lou.
Yeah, that is one drop I can definitely isolate.
You should play the Sheik's clip over my comment. Yeah.
Right. So,
all right. Old country style.
But what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, this guy was a pretty important figure. He trained a lot of Steamboat. He was there in the class with Patera and Flair. He served as Vern's main trainer. But before that, this guy was a huge deal in his home country. And it really goes in. He discusses with great clarity what it was like growing up in Iran and how wrestling basically pulled him away from some very humble and very meager upbringings. He became a bodyguard for the Shah. And the story that came out that I was not aware of was that there was a wrestler, and forgive me, I can't remember his name right now, but who was an even bigger figure. I mean, a national figure in Iran, because he was the champion wrestler, and I think in a different weight class. And the Shah, apparently, when these gentlemen would do well in tournaments, would come to them and say, what can I give you? What can I give you? Can I give you a car? Can I give you a house? Can I give you money? And this other wrestler apparently at one point said to the Shah, you know, instead of giving me all these gifts, why don't you build roads for the people, improve the conditions? Why don't you give food to the people and help the poor people out? That's what I want you to do with the money that you would normally give me. And apparently it humiliated the Shah. And so somewhat mysteriously after that, the gentleman passed away very suddenly, if you get my drift, Barry.
Yeah.
And so so the Sheik said, you know, I realized if the Shah could take this guy out, you know, he could take me out in the beat of a heart. So I need to get out of here. So he traveled to New York. I'm not sure if it was for a tournament or whatever. And he ends up migrating to Minnesota. And it tells a very interesting story about how he, you know, became part of Vern Gagne's camp, became a trainer there. And he ends up meeting a local woman. And it's interesting, you know, you see a lot of wrestlers, Barry, you know, and it's safe to say a lot of them go for a very specific type of woman. Am I fair in saying that?
Yeah. That's okay. Fair.
So his wife, though, is not the normal wrestler wife. I will say that. And I am not in any way disparaging her. She looks like the type of woman that you'd see walking in your local grocery store. OK, she's not a runway model. She's not a bad looking woman, but she's just seems not the normal standard, store bought boobs, that kind of, you know, mini skirts, fake tan and bleached blonde hair that you see a lot of wrestlers with. This is not what the Sheik's wife looks like. But so, and they go into the detail of her life with the Sheik. Of course, the Sheik having lost one of his daughters to a murder in an event that just completely changed his entire life. And he very tearfully describes the details of his daughter's death, and it's just gut-wrenching listening to that. But I can tell you, I really thought this is not a movie I sit there and say, oh, I enjoyed it. There are parts of this movie that I really enjoyed, that the story was very interesting. There's part of it, it's gut-wrenching, his decline into a drug addiction, and his wife staying with him when everything tells her to throw him out because he's lost control of his ability to say no, and how he reaches the bottom feeders of society, you know, to feed his drug addiction. It's very sad in parts, but there are other parts where people are talking about their stories. You know, Jim Duggan discusses the very famous incident where he and the Sheik are pulled over, and they're in the middle of a program in the WWF, and here they get pulled over, and I think the Sheik has weed in the car with them. And, you know, that's kind of a funny story, but a really compelling story that I really recommend, Barry. I don't know if you had a chance to see it yet.
I didn't. I know that it is on Prime, and it's right next to another movie that you're going to be discussing a little bit later. And I've seen the two of them, and I haven't watched either of them. I think my thing with the Sheik's story, and I'm aware of a lot of it, is I am aware of so much of his story, but I also I know that a lot of it's going to be a downer, right, Jeff?
Well, now I'm not going to say this is not an upbeat movie. Okay, that there are parts of it. But I mean, I will say it's very uplifting, talking about his getting away from the oppression of his youth. You know, that and making himself into something that's very uplifting. You know, escaping his homeland to come to the United States. He's so appreciative of the fact that he lives in this country. You know, he wears the headband with the flag. And, you know, there are parts of the movie that are very uplifting, but I would be lying if I didn't say there are also parts that are very downbeat too.
Yeah, definitely. I probably will wind up watching it at some point too. We've been talking about possibly using the Sheik, the Iron Sheik, for a fan fest down in Florida. So I think if that was to happen, I would absolutely watch this movie ahead of time. But yeah, it does look interesting. I will say that.
So your second choice, Barry.
My second choice is a movie called Camp Hollywood. So this is, again, one of these that I stumbled on about 11:30 one night. And I absolutely just loved it because it reminded me of a lot of my experiences in Los Angeles some 30 years ago. There is a hotel out there, and it's a legendary Hollywood hotel. I was in the hotel during my last trip. I just stopped over because I used to go to parties at this hotel, but it used to be a residency hotel where now it's no longer. I think it strictly is just on a weekly basis, but people would actually come and they would stay for a month, 6 months, or a year, and they would actually move into the hotel. And it was, you know, literally from Hollywood Boulevard, let's say where the Chinese Theater is, which is a pretty famous landmark in Hollywood. It's maybe a 5-minute walk. So it's right in that area. And it's a hotel that, when this was filmed, was for the most part a bunch of struggling artists who are trying to make it. Singers, actors, comedians, people that have moved in, that are paying their, you know, $300 a week, $400 a week, whatever it is, and trying to make it in Hollywood. And it's an interesting movie, I think, also because you've got some very unique people that are in this movie. The guy who made this film was a comedian from Canada named Steve Markle. And
it wasn't Urkel, was it?
It wasn't Urkel. Urkel would have been a good addition to this movie too, Jeff. But he wasn't in this film. But this guy came and he decided to make a documentary. And I got to admit, it's absolutely just fantastic because he looks at, I don't know, 10 to 12 people and really follows them on a day-to-day basis. And you've got, you know, the young innocents that have come from Canada. Two of these girls are just absolutely drop-dead, you know, gorgeous, like just out of this world, just beautiful. But, you know, you've got a guy, there's this guy, he was a Hollywood actor, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher his last name. His name was Roy Dotrice, something like that. And the second you see him, you immediately know who this guy is. And he's probably in his late 70s, but he and his wife are actually living in the hotel. And he, you know what, he was on, the fuck was he on, Airwolf? He was on
Jan Michael Vincent, of course.
Yeah. Right? Oh my God. There's a story there, but that should be a documentary on Jan Michael Vincent. My God. But so, I mean, this guy had actually, he'd been in a lot of movies and done a lot of theater. He was a classically trained Shakespearean actor. And now he's living in this hotel with his wife. You got another guy that was a musician from New York, and I guess it played for Lincoln Center. You know, so I forget what instrument he played, the oboe, the harmonic. I don't know. I don't fucking remember. But he was part of the orchestra from New York, and his wife died. His life went off the rails. Massive alcoholic, starts drinking from the time that he wakes up and is blackout drunk. And they follow these people on a daily basis. There's a guy that was a bank robber. There's a porn star that's in here. But this is known in the community, and then I'll tell you a funny story about it. This is known in the community of where young actors are. And have you ever heard of the actress, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher her name as well, Malin Ackerman?
I have heard that name. Where do I know her from?
She's been in a bunch of movies. Very attractive. I think she's Swedish by birth, but she also came from Canada.
You might know her from the Watchmen movie.
Okay.
I think she was Silk Spectre in that.
She was in a big movie too, though, wasn't she, Lou? Didn't she do something big?
I'll get back to you on that.
All right. And she
further
was
also, research to be provided by Sweet
yes,
and Kibble.
And Lou will be checking in momentarily. She was also in a Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie, Rampage. Recently, but she's actually in this movie in brief clips as somebody who's living at the hotel, and they party every night. The beauty of it too, all these like 20 somethings get together and they have these massive blowout parties every night. It's great. But a lot of actors, you know, Saul Rubinek is a character actor that's been in a million movies.
Unforgiven.
He's been in so many movies. He actually comes by and does like acting workshops and seminars with all these young people. Maury Chaykin, another guy that's a character actor, and Mark Margolis. Zach, do you know who Zach? I called you Zach, Jeff. Go figure.
I feel so much younger.
Yeah, you should. Do you know who Mark Margolis is? You know who he is, but by name, do you know who he is?
Okay, give me a famous role.
Breaking Bad. He was what was the guy's name in the wheelchair during Breaking Bad?
Oh my God! Yes, the Mexican mafia guy. Yeah,
he's fucking unbelievable. He was
He was great in that. Yeah,
Scarface. He's been in a bunch. He's a great character actor. A bunch. He's actually in this movie and he does these workshops. So this is such a riveting film because there's and following all these different stories and all these different, you know, walks of life, and they all converge in this one hotel, and the way this movie kind of gets wrapped up at the end. And, you know, there's good news. There's obviously a little bit of tragedy that takes place. But I went in and I researched everybody in this film to see who's alive, who's passed on. But years ago, I went to a party in this hotel, and when I was at that party, Ron Jeremy was at that party.
The Hedgehog.
It was a much younger version of what he is currently, but he was actually there. That was the only celebrity I ever saw there, at least the only one I'm aware of. But this is, I think, one of my favorite docs over the last 3 to 5 years. And just because it moves quick and everyone is so interesting. And this guy, I think he's a first-time filmmaker, but he just stumbled upon this really interesting subject. So highly recommended.
All right. Okay. So my second film, as Barry alluded to, that will pop up on Prime right next to one another, a movie that seems like it's got kind of a polarizing effect on wrestling fans, and that is 350 Days. This is the movie that came out last year that features interviews with, good Lord, quite the cross-section of wrestlers, everyone from superstar Billy Graham, Bret Hart, Greg Valentine, Jimmy Snuka, J.J. Dillon. There's something from a lot of people. And a lot of people, one of the complaints I saw was they spent a little too much time with a few different guys rather than give every guy, you know, say 5 or 10 minutes. They gave some guys 15 minutes, some guys 5. And so there were some guys that the people that watched the movie felt got a little too much face time. But what it is essentially is it's wrestlers sitting down and talking about what happened when they went on the road. and what happened, you know, the ribs they played on one another, the stories of guys interacting with one another, interacting with fans, interacting with arena rats, and women that would be there and help them, you know, not necessarily for sexual purposes. They'd go out and get them food, or they would, you know, take them to the airport, something like that. And just all kind of different stories about what life was like back in the not just the territorial days, but the crazy mid-80s WWF schedule that they had to follow, where they're in, you know, across the country. And good Lord, Barry, I can't imagine what those guys must have gone through working like, you know, 30, 40 days straight, with not going home and having to live out of a hotel room. That's one thing. You know, we go to an arena and we see a match and we, you know, bitch and complain because, oh, instead of having a 4.5-star match, they have a 3.5-star match. And yeah, you don't stop and think about the travel schedule these guys were on and to some extent still are on, but not nearly as bad as it was back in the day. But I thought it was a pretty compelling look, Barry, at what those guys had to go through back then.
Oh, so you did like it. Okay. Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of mixed about it. I haven't seen it. It's right when you look on Prime, it's right next to the Sheik documentary. I think what's prevented me from seeing this film thus far is the reviews from educated wrestling fans was that no new ground was broken here. It was that you weren't going to walk away and go, oh my God, I learned this and I learned this and whatever. It's that, you know, for a lot of people, it seemed to be the same retelling of the stories, but based off of what you just said, I may actually change that and go ahead and watch this.
And I will just leave you with this, Barry. There is one wrestler that is interviewed, and there's probably about 20 different guys that are interviewed. I will just say there is one guy, I will not mention his name because I do not know this for sure, who appeared to be, let's just say, not feeling well that day.
Are you saying under the influence?
I did not say that. I alluded to that, but I didn't say it. So
all right,
I want
you to... Do me a favor, text me the name, and then I'll tell you what I think. How about that?
Okay.
And I'll tell you right now, without even watching the film, what I think.
Wait just a second.
I'd be curious. Yeah. So also, just as a to back this up a little bit. Come on, Jeff. Really? Helen Keller.
It's just
knows.
Supposition. I can't say for sure. You know,
so
allegation.
Jeff has just texted me, and it's come on, Marty Jannetty. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's what you said. I did not say
that.
I
said exactly. Okay, so yes, there is a. I would say there's a great chance that Marty Jannetty was under the influence for the filming of this, and I haven't even seen the film, and I could say that. So I will. But you know what, Jeff? Can I say something? You just sold this fucking movie to me. You, sir. Just sold this movie because now I am going to watch this tonight and I'm looking for Marty Jannetty in this film.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Number three, Barry, on your list.
They should be paying you royalties right now for this.
They should be paying me something. That's for damn sure. So yes. Number three.
So to back up a little bit. Yep. Just a Malin Ackerman. And is it Malin? Malin? I'm pretty sure it's Ackerman, but she was on the Showtime series Billions, which was an excellent series, by the way, which we've never talked about, but she was on that show as well. Thank you, sweet Lou. Appreciate that. Moving on, Jeff. So my next one is one that, again, I got a little misty-eyed. I got a little sad. It's called The Gits, and this was a band that was led by a female lead singer in Seattle in the late 90s, early 2000s by the name of Mia Zapata. And what was interesting was I remember, all right, well, I guess I got to go for it. So she was killed. She was brutally raped, murdered, strangled, beaten, and killed on the streets of Seattle one morning. And it was like 2 or 3 a.m. And I remember seeing it, whether it was on Dateline or 2020, but on one of the news magazine shows. And when I saw that this was on either Netflix or Prime, I was like, you know what, I got to watch this. But it's really great. It's a real tribute to this band who, from all accounts, was on the verge of making it. I mean, when you hear the footage and you see, they were really good. it's a very compelling story, and it was obviously made by somebody that was emotionally attached to her, because this movie is, in a lot of ways, even though it's called The Gits, which was the name of the band, this is kind of a love letter to the late Mia Zapata. And it's not a story, you know, you hear, okay, it's going to be a rock and roll documentary, so you're going to have a lot of sex and drugs and alcohol. It's not about that. It's really about loss, despair, hope, community, and then life itself eventually. There, you know, everybody loved her first off. And I don't think it was one of these phony kind of loves that come forth afterwards. You know, oh, you know, we miss her. She was great. This is the kind of thing that I don't think a lot of these people that knew her ever fully recovered from. One was her writing partner, who was also a member of the band. And he says, we used to fight a lot. He goes, I'm not the same human being any longer, that she's no longer here. And I believe it. And her father, who deeply, deeply loved his child, and he gives a testimony to his daughter, and it'll haunt you. It is. It's such a genuine love that people had for her. So what does make this interesting, Jeff, and I wasn't aware of this, is as I was watching this film, I was saying, shit, her murder was never solved. I'm going to bring this up on the next Unsolved Mysteries episode that we do, which I love, by the way.
Well, are you saying we have another one of those coming up in the near future, Barry?
I believe, don't we?
I believe we do.
So much fun. But Jeff, what makes this really interesting is that some 10 years later, and I forget exactly what the time frame is, her murder is actually solved during the making of this film.
Wow.
When the camera started rolling, her murder, it was a cold case. It was unsolved. By the time the documentary was finished, the case would be closed, and the footage shot for the film was actually used in court. So I'm going to tell you, if you're listening to this, put The Gits on your list. It is, if you like rock and roll, if you want to see a true crime get solved, and if you want to cry. Because this is really one of the most heartfelt movies I think I may have ever seen. I can't say enough good about the movie The Gits.
All right. I'll put that on my to watch list, Bear. So my third movie that I will discuss now is a movie that was on it was on Showtime. This is not a single feature. This is a show with five episodes. It was on Showtime. And actually, I posted something about it on my own page, and our old friend Benji reached out and said he had been watching it also. It's a show called Murder in the Bayou. It's available on Showtime if you want to check it out. Think about this, Barry. You're in a small town in Louisiana, a town called Jennings, okay, which, let's be honest, Jennings is not the first town you think of when you think of towns in Louisiana. It's a very small town. Sort of a town on the interstate that goes down to New Orleans or whatever. It's a town that you pass by. And over the course of about 2 or 3 years in this one small town, eight women died. Mysterious death. Yeah, this is not New York City, and eight women die over the course of a couple of years. This is eight women in a small drive-by town that die. Now, quite candidly, they were all either involved in the sex trade or drug industry down there. Small-time dealers or users, as they were. They were addicts. They were women who. As I like to say, we're living on the edge of society. That's a nice, polite way of saying it. And over the course of the first couple episodes, you know, you feel bad for these women that this has happened to them, but you're like, yeah, I'm not terribly surprised this has happened to them. And you're introduced to this man who is the uncle, I believe, of one of the women who was of a suspect. And so you're sitting there after about 2 or 3 episodes and you're going, oh, yeah, this guy, I don't know what they're waiting for. Why haven't they picked this guy? Because obviously this guy is involved. And then when you get to the fourth episode, you find out that there was one more thing that they had in common, and that they all knew, had a relationship with, or were basically just F buddies with this guy who happened to be in charge of the local jail. And apparently, while these women were in jail, let's just say he took advantage of their status. And so there was this common thread that suddenly came out about this guy who was in charge of the county jail. And, you know, here's a term I've used more than once on this show, Barry. You go down the old rabbit hole, and it's a really sad story about these women who were preyed upon. This is an unsolved mystery. These 8 murders, they've never come to grips. It's more like they kind of know what happened, but they can't prove it. You know, the person in question that I mentioned has never been indicted. The sheriff of the county mysteriously couldn't come up with any idea as to who might have killed these women, Barry. So, yeah, just a crazy, crazy story. Murder in the Bayou. Check it out. It's on Showtime.
So a very small town in Louisiana, 8 women. What was the time frame that they all died?
It's about a 2 or 3 year period.
And the FBI didn't get involved in this?
Well, you know, let's just say that at some point, I believe they did, but there was a lot of doors being closed in their faces. There was a lot of, let's just say, local law enforcement coming together and trying to keep lid on certain things.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It's a pretty crazy story. There was a journalist that invested, good Lord, about 10 years of his life to go in. And I'm talking about, this is not a town that's got the Walmart and the Target and all that. This is a small town. And a lot of these women's bodies were found on dirt roads way the hell out there where there's not a lot of traffic lights and that kind of thing. So it's a pretty freaking creepy story, Barry. I'll tell you that.
That's what it sounds like. And you said this is on Showtime?
Correct.
All right. It's currently on Showtime because I am actually going to seek this out as well. How long is this one? Is this?
That's like 5 episodes. Each episode, I want to say 45 to 50 minutes each.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to have to watch that. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. So your number 4 movie, Barry.
I think this is my last one, Jeff.
Well, okay. I guess I'll have 5.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not. I do have your 100% correct, Jeff.
Again.
I have 2. So my number 4 movie is a movie which also, Jeff, I discovered on Showtime about a year ago. It is called XTC, This Is Pop. And XTC is the name of the band, and it's 3 letters. It's not ecstasy. It's XTC. Have you ever heard of this band? I think you have.
I have, right? In fact, heard of this band.
Yeah. So one of my favorite bands of all time. And I've got 3 or 4 of their albums. I've got their greatest hits. I know Gabe Daigle and I have waxed poetically about our love for XTC, but I've never seen them.
But not ecstasy.
No, we didn't about ecstasy.
You do not want to endorse that.
No, not until it's legal, at least. But this is a band that I was always hopeful I would be able to see live. And after seeing the documentary, I'll never be able to see them live because it's all explained that they're never going to tour again. They haven't toured in some 30 to 35 years, and they're never going to be going on a tour again. But this really goes in, and it's a very interesting style of documentary as well. It's there's some animation in it. There's live performances, interviews with all the members. The lead singer is Andy Partridge. And Ecstasy is known, too, Making Plans for Nigel, Dear God, Senses Working Overtime, Generals and Majors. They've had a lot of hits. But I never fully understood about Andy Partridge and what he went through. But it's a very poignant movie because he discusses what happened. So they were on tour. And this would be, I guess, you know, somewhere around 82, 83. And he suffered a nervous breakdown on the stage. They canceled the rest of the dates. Obviously, they've never toured afterwards. They cost the band, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then basically Andy Partridge quit Valium cold turkey. He had been on Valium since the age of 12. It was prescribed to him following his mother being institutionalized. So mental illness was running in the family, and he had been taking Valium for some, you know, 20 years, give or take. I don't know what the exact length of time was, and had a nervous breakdown. And they basically, that's it. So I guess emotionally, he's extremely fragile. They were doing new music for a while. I don't think they've done anything in maybe 15 or 20 years. But if you like this band, it's a real good look at, I think, a band, you know, a lot of new, and I love new wave, Jeff. That's been clearly established.
I think we've established that.
I think we have, but I'll be the first one to also tell you that a lot of it falls into the one-hit wonder because the musical talent on some of it is suspect. With Ecstasy, I think you've got a real great band here that just never fully hit what they were, their potential, what they were supposed to be in this country. They were right there, ready to break through, kind of like a Simple Minds, a Duran Duran. You know, they would have taken that next step, but unfortunately, his mental illness kind of stopped that. So, highly recommended. You can see it. I believe it might be on Netflix or Prime as well, but I discovered this on Showtime. It is Ecstasy. This is Pop.
Okay, Barry, I'm going to throw something at you right now because I know you are all things new wave.
Yes, sir.
Tell me, since you just referred to them as one of the most talented bands in new wave, tell me your top three most talented new wave bands ever. Not who had the most hits. Guys that you
thought. Or my favorites.
Just had the most talent going for them.
Yeah, XTC would be one. Big fan is Stan Ridgway. You know Stan Ridgway as the lead singer of Walla Voodoo, which was Mexican radio. I absolutely think they're incredible. And I'll throw Duran Duran in there because I don't think that Duran Duran is still relevant to this day. They've got a new album coming out next year. And I should say Depeche Mode. There's another one. Depeche Mode has been putting out music now for 35, almost 40 years, and they had a sold-out tour. They were selling out major arenas last year. So, yeah, I would look at those guys.
I'm looking for a good controversy on the board as people that don't agree with your choices offer their choices. So,
me
anyway,
too.
My number four choice, I'll tell you a little story about this movie and how I stumbled upon it. First of all, I was trying to watch a movie on Amazon Prime, and for some reason, my Amazon Prime froze up. So I had to go to another source, and it went to YouTube, and I found this movie on YouTube. And here's where I had a little reminiscing as I was getting ready to watch this movie. You know, over the years, and I worked at the courthouse for about 20 years, I worked with a guy named Hugh Fitzpatrick. And Hugh Fitzpatrick was a guy who was from Philadelphia. And was a huge sports fan. You know, Barry, you have guys and people that come in and out of your life, and somehow you lose touch with them. And I've over the years, you know, he retired about 7 or 8 years ago, and I lost touch with him. But was a huge Philadelphia sports fan. So I know Jamie Ward and Eric Chulminski and guys like that are going to enjoy this selection. But he was a huge fan of the Philadelphia Flyers. And we used to watch, believe it or not, we would have lunch together. We would go into a courtroom where there's a TV and a videotape so you could do DUI videos. But we would go in there and watch hockey fight tapes. And because Hugh was a huge hockey fight guy. And he would talk about, when I was growing up and I watched the Philadelphia Flyers. And for you Philadelphia Flyer fans, if I butchered this phrase, I apologize. But it went something like this. They had, of course, Dave the Hammer Schultz, who led the league in penalties with something like, 490 minutes in penalties 1 year, Barry. The average tough guy fighter now might have 150 minutes. Dave Schultz had 490-something minutes 1 year. They had Bob the Chief Kelly and Andre Moose DuPont. And the line that Hugh would always give me that Philadelphia fans would recite was, Hammer Chief and the Moose, Broad Street Bullies on the Loose. And the movie that I'm talking about is a documentary called Broad Street Bullies. And it's a look back at the Philadelphia Flyers between 1974 and 1976 when they won two Stanley Cups and they went to the finals in 1 year and lost in the finals. And, you know, it's not really a movie, I don't personally think, that's just for hockey fans. I think this is a movie that anybody that likes sports can identify with because it talks about how this team completely unified a city that was, quite frankly, a town that felt like they were a town of losers because their baseball team hadn't won anything in like 10 years. Football team hadn't won anything in almost 15 years. They just weren't known for having winning sports teams. And here this sort of, you know, ragtag band of misfits from Canada comes in. They were an expansion team. They built the team up and they built the team up much like in the movie Slapshot by being the toughest guys in the league. They were the guys that always got in fights. They always stood up for each other. They show these photos where these guys are stitched up. It's just, it's a brand of hockey that is not played today that a lot of people that are old-time hockey fans really miss. So if you've ever had a chance to see the movie Slapshot and you enjoyed that, give yourself, go to YouTube. It's on YouTube. It's called Broad Street Bullies. It's maybe an hour long as these guys who are now all like in their 60s are reminiscing and with videotapes, lots of good hockey fight footage of guys just pummeling each other, you know, and it's really an entertaining movie. So if you're any kind of fan of sports, not just hockey, but of any kind of sports, I think you'll really feel a connection to this movie, Broad Street Bullies, Barry.
Yeah, and I've seen it, Jeff. This is required required viewing if you live within the Philadelphia region. So
before you move in, they require you to watch this.
The law. Yeah, exactly. So I've seen it. It's great, too. And here's the thing about this film, too. I guess you have to like violence to some degree to see this movie. But I don't think you have to love hockey or sports because it's so interesting hearing these guys talk about a lot of the events that took place 40, 50 years earlier, whatever the time frame was.
Well, and you know, one of, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know, if you like wrestling, because one of the things they talk about is stuff that happened off the ice, how there was a bar that was right down the street and they would all go to the bar after a game. So all the fans went there and would start buying them beer. And apparently there was copious beer drank. I know that's a stunning development to some people who might be hockey fans, but you know, just stories about them getting, you know, going because they had such a reputation, they would go to different cities and much like wrestling, they were the villains of the story. And, you know, they were hung in effigy and, you know, Bobby Clark, who was the captain of the team, talks about getting death threats and he's laughing as he's talking, you know, like a good wrestling heel would. He said, yeah, oh yeah, we used to get death threats all the time. And as he tells the story, he starts laughing. So, you know, I should say if you're a wrestling fan, you'll find something about this movie to like.
I think so, too. It's an extremely watchable documentary. I loved it.
Yeah. OK, so your number five movie, Barry.
So that's it. My last choice, the movie called Pull Up L.A. This was probably the one that I think I watched this like 2 weeks ago. It's on Prime. And again, the plot summary of this one doesn't really say a whole lot. And as I go in and as I'm watching it, you know, as I'm reading. Hold on one second. Jeff, I apologize. I'm recording. I'll be done in 20 minutes. Will you shut the door? I apologize, guys.
Oh, how dare you?
I know my wife came down to exercise and work out. So
you've got the floor for now, Barry.
I've got the floor. I was it. I threw out. So, okay. So I'll go back to it. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is one of the movies that I pull up on Amazon. It's 11:30 at night, as I've mentioned, and I'm reading the plot summary and I'm going, yeah, you know, maybe I'll get some good shots of Los Angeles in this film without expecting how much I was going to love this film. And what it basically is groups of photographers, artists, performance artists, makeup artists will all gather once a week in various locations in Los Angeles, take over the area and take photos and then put these photos all on social media. And I said, yeah, you know what? Maybe I'll see something cool with this. Wow, was this interesting. So it basically follows the group of people in Los Angeles. And what they do is they will put out on social media, I believe through Instagram, we're meeting up hypothetically at the Basin, the LA Basin on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. The next thing you know, 300 people show up. And who shows up? Maybe 100 photographers, various makeup artists, then models will show up wearing all kinds of makeup, people in outrageous costumes and outfits. They do all these smoke bombs and lighting effects, and they'll take these photos and then post this on social media. And a lot of this was designed, ironically, to get people off of social media. So instead of looking at your phone and communicating, they wanted to have an event where people could get together, could spend time together, and interact as artists. And I started watching this movie and I was blown away by it. So there's a couple of amazing photographers. One is this guy named Yancey. And Yancey is kind of the guy, kind of the ringleader, the guy that put all of this together. And he takes amazing photos, but he's also one of the models in a sense. He always wears a skull mask. And they do certain things with these smoke bombs where these different colors, blue smoke and red smoke, and he'll put these in front of him and then kind of come out through the middle of the smoke bombs. So there'll be 100 people taking his photos. And then they post all these photos on Instagram and Facebook and whatever else. But just captivating to see it. And it's also the challenges of what some of these people go through when they get to some of these locations, because they're doing this. These are organized events that they don't have any permits or anything like that. So they'll show up here, and then next thing you know, the cops are showing up, security is showing up. You know, there's lots of arguments. But what's also interesting and what I took away from it was there's this commonality that all these people have. Like, you see the makeup artists, and there's these beautiful women and girls that are coming, and they'll put on makeup and they develop the persona of whatever makeup they're wearing. But with all these people put into a spot, again, it's 100 to 300 to 400 people, there's no violence whatsoever. You've got all these people that just have this one common goal, and they'll do this for 2 hours. So I can't recommend this enough. And I know on the outside, it sounds very esoteric, like, you know, that's it. They're photographers. But when you see these people and how they react, you know, a lot of them are antisocial, but they get together and all of a sudden it's like you've got 300 people that all are thinking alike, and they're like the best of friends. I can't recommend this movie enough, Jeff.
Okay. So Barry, let me ask you before I get to my final choice of all the movies that you mentioned, the Parking Lot movie, Camp Hollywood, The Gets, XTC, This Is Pop, and Pull Up LA. Which one, if you had to just take one, which one were you going to recommend to somebody? Which one would you say, Jeff, watch this movie tonight?
I am going to say Camp Hollywood.
Okay.
I love them all though, Jeff. There's
it's
not
like
one
asking you to pick one of your children. I know
it is. I'm going to say Camp Hollywood. You can't go wrong, but if I'm saying it to you with, I would say Camp Hollywood. And then I would say the Parking Lot movie, because I think you would really enjoy the dialogue between these parking lot attendants. It almost seems scripted because it doesn't seem real, but Camp Hollywood to me, there was just something about it, something magical.
Okay. So I have recommended four films that I think our listeners would enjoy and that you would enjoy. But if I'm going to pick one movie to recommend, and Barry, this, if you've never seen this movie, you're really going to have to go outside the box on this one, because I have to tell you, folks, this is not a movie that when I tell you what it's about, you're going to go, oh, yeah, I got to run to see that. I am going to absolutely wholeheartedly recommend on HBO a movie called Saving Face. Saving Face is a movie about a plastic surgeon whose name, let me give him full credit, is Dr. Mohammed Jawad, who lives in London. He candidly admits that most of what he does is boob jobs. But a couple times a year, he goes to Pakistan to help women who have been, Barry, I can't believe I'm saying this, burned in acid attacks by their spouses. By the way, did you know that up until a couple of years ago, that was not illegal? Oh, my
That's
God.
Terrible. Barry. Yeah. Women, oh, man.
And when you see the women, I'm telling you, it's not easy to see what these women have had done to them. And they had no fucking recourse. There is one woman who has been horribly disfigured by her husband, who, by the way, says not only did it not happen, it was some other guy that did that. She had to go back to the house. Let me tell you what happened to this woman. And I'm not trying to you know, gross anybody out, but this actually happened to this woman. The husband pours battery acid on her, okay? Her sister-in-law then goes, pours gasoline on top of her, but on top of the battery acid, her mother-in-law then goes and throws a match at her. She's,
wow.
She's lit on fire, okay? Now, if that's not bad enough, okay, then because of circumstances, because she leaves with their child, The child becomes sick. She cannot afford to pay for the child's health care. She has to move back in with that family. Okay. Wait a minute. I'm not done. They then take the child to a part of the house and they let the woman live in a room in the house. Okay. The room they choose to have this woman live in is the room that she was burned in. Then, wait, it gets even worse than that. They then go and build a wall so that the woman cannot have access to her child, Barry. Just completely,
wow,
just fucking barbaric, okay? But now, as much as a downer as that is, one of the things that this movie talks about is how one of these women who has been horribly disfigured has the courage to go and she speaks to a lawmaker, a lawyer, and they try to push forward a law to make this a crime. And you see this woman and that part of the movie. Let me tell you something. I'll just say, you know, no spoiler alerts here. There's a part in the ending where literally I found myself raising my hand and fist and going, fuck yeah, man. Fuck yeah, you did it. And you came through with what you wanted to get done. And, you know, and the guy that did it to her ends up paying a very heavy price. I won't say anything more than that, but that makes the movie, you know, really, it ends on such an upbeat ending that it makes the movie worthwhile. But oh my God, Barry, this is such a horrible story, but it needs to be told because now there are consequences to these men. These men had, oh, you know, it's just amazing that they sit there and say, oh no, I didn't do that. No, the guy that, the woman was on a fire. No, she stumbled and fell into a candle, I think is what he said, or something like that. And that these women, wow, have to continue to live in the society. And, you know, of course they don't want their, you know, because they wear the, being completely insensitive, I don't know what the scarf across the face anyway, because of their religious convictions, but they do it also because of the burns that are on there. Cause these women are being burned on their face, you know? And then to show, let me get back to the doctor. The work that the doctor does is absolutely fucking amazing as he reconstructs these women's faces to make them where, not that they're presentable to society, you know, but that they're presentable to themselves, you know? And it's really an amazing, uplifting story about the work this guy is doing. So,
yeah,
I can't recommend this movie enough, Barry.
Yeah, but so it's funny, too. I mean, it's actually not funny, but it's when we were talking about documentaries a year ago, you know, some of the choices that I think me specifically, though you had a couple there, some of the choices were a little depressing. This one sounds just gut-wrenching, if anything. It sounds, yeah, brutal.
And I'll tell you, it's a 45-minute movie, okay? There are some very gut-wrenching scenes in the movie. You know, when the woman who – there's a scene early in the movie where the woman who was just burned removes her veil – and you see the injury that was inflicted upon her. But then the doctor begins to work to help her regain her sense of self-worth, I guess is the best way of putting it, you know, so that she becomes presentable, not to anybody else, but to herself and, you know, and to her children. And, you know, the work that's being done by the lawyer to, you know, push this law through the National Assembly to make these men suffer the consequences of what they've done. And to think that, you know, and the crazy thing is that they talk about how that the women they've interviewed, because these filmmakers went over there and they were there for a couple of years. And they talk about these were just the women they saw, that there were all these reports that were, or all these incidents that were never reported. All these women that have been burned because apparently, you know, that they work on this honor code, you know, like if somehow the husband feels like the wife has wronged him or shamed him in some way in his own mind, that it's perfectly okay to throw battery acid on her, you know, and suffer no consequences for doing that. It's absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, I believe this has also taken place in England a few times as well. So yeah, it is terrible too. And it's amazing to think, as you pointed out, this has only been a law for a year or two.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. Saving Face, it is a because I will tell you, there are a number of movies. If you go on the IMDb thing, it came out in 2012. That's the one you're going to want to be looking for.
Okay.
And it's regarding Dr. Mohammed Jawad. And so, you know, Barry, each of us offered five documentaries that we think are worth people going out of their way to check out. So a couple things before we begin to wrap up here, Barry. Barry, I thought I'd give you a little surprise, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, surprises are a great thing with me.
Barry, let me just offer a quick F, marry, or kill. We haven't done that in a while, Barry.
We have not.
Are you ready for a good F, marry, or kill?
It is a special Thanksgiving holiday F, marry, or kill.
Exactly. Yes. A holiday yes. edition. Of F, marry, or kill. So, Barry, I've chosen a very interesting F, marry, or kill this week. Barry, all right. I call this one Hot Women with Annoying Voices. Are you ready where's for that
Fran,
one?
Where's Fran Drescher on
She
this
is
list?
On the list. You called that one. Okay.
Yes.
Barry, I'm giving you Fran Drescher, Rosie Perez, Bernadette Peters. Now, I want you to take all these women in their prime when they were at their most beautiful.
Okay. And that's fair. So we're going to kill Fran Drescher, which I feel bad about. We're going to F Bernadette Peters in her prime. Because she had a rockin' body, and actually attractive woman, great hair, rockin' body. But Jeff, I had a crush on Rosie Perez in her prime, and she did a topless scene, and I forget what movie that was, and I just remember going, "Oh my God!" I think it might have been a Spike Lee movie that she did that.
Was it in White Man Can't Jump?
I think she's in it. She might be. I know she's in the T-shirt where they're very visible. Her voice is horrifically annoying, but what a body and pretty girl too. I like Rosie, so I would marry her because again, the benefit is you could F her all the time if you marry her. But yeah, that's where I would go. How about you, Jeff? What would you?
I'm gonna kill off Rosie because that voice. I don't care how good the body is. I couldn't take it. I'm going to F Fran Drescher because she did have a rockin' body, but that voice. Oh. Yes. And I'm going to marry Bernadette Peters because someone posted a picture of her on Twitter yesterday, and I saw it, and I was like, wow, man, I forgot. And I believe when she made, if I'm not mistaken, when she made The Jerk with Steve Martin, maybe they had a onset hookup. Yeah,
they did. Yeah, so, yeah. They were together for a while, actually. And she was a Broadway star. I know she was a dancer, but her body was, and it was at a different level too. So Rosie, so that's interesting too. And I never really paid. Did Bernadette Peters have a very horrific voice?
Well, she kind of had a little baby talk voice to her.
Okay. I could dig that. I don't know. I got no problem with that. Sure.
Right. Okay. Now, before we leave, one last surprise for you, Barry.
Uh-oh.
I'm throwing out Florida Man or Not. One story to leave the listeners with. Barry, are you ready to go?
Let's do it.
Barry, it involves, so right away.
Love it. All right.
A stripper is facing criminal charges after allegedly kicking the manager of a gentleman's club in the genitals while wearing high-heel exotic dancer shoes, according to a police report. Investigators say that Lakeisha Ortiz became unruly early yesterday morning after the manager of Sensations, you know, the stripper clubs, they always have great names, Barry, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Ask her to go home for the evening. Cops noted that Ortiz, who is, quote, employed as an exotic dancer at Sensation, was asked to leave the club because she was intoxicated. Seen it right? They have her picture. Ortiz allegedly threw beer bottles and glass drinking cups upon being asked by the manager to depart the club. Later, as club security and the manager sought to de-escalate the situation, Ortiz, quote, front kicked the manager directly in his genitals while wearing her work shoes. Barry, Florida or not?
Oh, it's certainly, if it's not Florida, it certainly could be Florida. So I will have to go with that. Yes, Jeff, it is Florida.
Clearwater, Florida, Barry.
Oh, what was the name of the club again?
Sensations. Have you been there? Maybe.
There's a chance, yes. There's a
good
chance
Howard Baum has been there, too.
Well, that's a given, though.
I think he's hitting every strip club in Florida.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
All right, Barry. About ready for the go home, my friend?
It was like a five-hour show we did. Lou, is that a five-hour show?
I think so. Somewhere close to that. Maybe we'll do part two.
Right. Well, we're hitting part two later today, part three.
there you go.
So anyway, all right, folks, we appreciate you checking us out. We are a member of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Special thanks and appreciation to our boy, Sweet Lou Kippelman, on the production duties, producer to the stars. By the way, Lou, join us real quick again. Lou, who was recently buried, we have not discussed this, a co-host of the Studcast with Ron Fuller. You know, Lou, apparently not happy with his work here on Breaking Kayfabe, taking his duties elsewhere. Lou, tell us about it.
Well, you know, a boy's got a side hustle. It happened to be that the great one was cramming in a little bit to put the finishing touches on episode 100, and he called an audible and asked if I'd be available to talk with Rob.
Had to squeeze in that interview that he had done with me for the 605, the one he did, I think, in May or June. That's how long ago that interview was done. So anyway, but Lou, we always appreciate your contributions to the show. Again, until next week, for Barry Rose and Lou Kippelman, we will see you next week.